Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to the July edition of City Talks. This month we'll be talking about air quality and air pollution in UK cities. Before we get to that discussion, I'm joined by my colleagues Naomi Clayton and Brian Semple to discuss the key policy developments of the past month. Brian, let's start with the Queen's speech. Very thin, as we expected. What did it have to say about cities?
Well, not a lot, to be honest. I think from an urban policy perspective, what was most interesting from the speech was what was missing from it, really. So in terms of what we had, you know, there's lots of kind of rhetoric, essentially, about, you know, tackling housing issues, and rebalancing the economy, that kind of thing. We also had announcements on the 8 bills that are coming up in terms to pave the way for Brexit. But really, as I say, what was missing from it was more significant, and in particular, the absence of any mention at all of business rates devolution, which was obviously a major policy announcement under the Cameron Osborne administration a couple of years ago. No real sense then of how big a priority this is going to be for the current government. And, you know, it doesn't mean that it's completely off the table. There's aspects of the business rates reforms which could be implemented without new legislation. But there's still a lot of question marks about this, and particularly, you know, how this might apply to, for example, the new Metro Mayors. What way that will work at a combined authority level, what responsibilities and powers they will have over this, the issues of pooling. So there's a bunch of things that are yet to be addressed, and it's unclear really from the Queen's speech and from the fact that government hasn't been talking publicly about that, what the next steps will be.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. You know, nothing on housing, but we had the housing white paper beforehand, and I think lots can probably still happen without legislation in that respect, can't it, I think?
Well, there was, I mean, the headline kind of grabbing announcements about scrapping letting fees for tenants,
yeah.
And there was another, you know, the government reaffirmed its commitment to tackle the housing crisis, but really didn't really build on any of the announcements from the white paper. If we look at the Conservative manifesto as well, you know, that had a commitment to rebalance housing across the country, which is pretty vague in itself. Certainly there isn't a recognition there, or there was no mention of the fact that, you know, different cities have different housing challenges, and there's no more detail about what this government might do for housing.
And interestingly, not related to the Queen's speech, and often in reaction to horrific events, we've seen how our new mayors across the country, although they've only been in place for 2 months or so, are beginning to assert themselves in some big issues. Burnham in relation to the events in Manchester, and obviously Khan in response to the incidents in London Bridge and in Grenville, and indeed Rotherham, Steve Rotherham, talking a little bit about the DUP deal.
Yeah, I think that's right. And in relation to those terrible incidents that you mentioned, it was the mayors really who were quickest to get down there on the ground and to be seen to be visible and offering that kind of leadership, more so than national politicians. And also then, as you say, responding to the DUP deal with the government and the at least £1 billion investment that brought to Northern Ireland. We've had Steve Rotherham and Andy Burnham both hitting the airwaves to make the case for their cities and their city regions to get more investment as well from the government off the back of that. And so, you know, what we're starting to see is it's a level of representation and visibility that those places wouldn't have had without having them there. And, you know, I think that it's really starting to see how the mayors, the role that they're going to play in this political landscape, and I'm sure that's only going to continue in the coming years.
Yeah, and interestingly, you know, both of the roles of the mayors not picked up not only in the national context, but you had, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post also writing about the prominence of these new metro mayors. Obviously, they're familiar in America with the role of mayor, so I think that's a sign of more things to come. Naomi, let's turn to you. And so last week we had the Matthew Taylor review on good work, on employment practices in relation to a changing labour market. What did it have to say? But more particularly, I suppose, you know, if the government begins to enact some of the recommendations he made, and we don't know if he will, they will, because you know we'll have to wait and see on that. What will that mean for cities up and down the country?
Yeah, so you know, there was a lot of reporting on the Taylor Review and how it was calling for greater protections for gig workers. But of course, that was actually quite a small part of the picture.
Yeah.
Really, it's about promoting good work across the economy. And when it comes to the quality of jobs, we know that there's a geography to that, in the same way there is when we look at the quantity of jobs as well. So in areas with higher levels of unemployment, you're also likely to see lower levels of wages, higher levels of job insecurity, and kind of greater use of things like 0 hours contracts and agency contracts, for instance. So when the government is considering adopting the recommendations from the Taylor Review, they need to consider how that's likely to play out across the country. We've obviously seen the Taylor Review call for the worker definition, the category in between employees and independent contractors, to be more clearly defined and renamed as dependent contractors. There's some evidence internationally that you may see a move from the employee category into that dependent contractor. That's something that we've seen happen in Italy, and particularly in southern Italy, where kind of you have more kind of slack labour market. So it's interesting to think about how these national level regulations might play out across the country. But of course, when it comes to promoting good work, it's not all about regulation. No. And this is something that the review also talks about. And it's important to consider the role that cities and local leaders can play in promoting good quality work as well.
Yeah, no, I think it's right. And I think, you know, he was very deliberate in saying that flexibilities and the flexible labour market had positive outcomes for the country. And yes, we might need to tweak and to tighten, but we don't want overhaul. I mean, that for me at least was one of the messages from looking through the review.
Yeah, I mean, that was a kind of key principle behind all of his recommendations or the review's recommendations, is to find this kind of appropriate balance between maintaining flexibility in the labour market that's seen a record number of jobs created, but also meanwhile preventing workers from being exploited. Well, that's that kind of so-called one-sided flexibility or exploitation in the labour market.
So it's been interesting to see how the government reacts and responds to the Taylor Review. I mean, I don't know whether it'd be interesting because the Prime Minister was there at the launch, whether that suggests that they are, you know, taking it very seriously, things to keep an eye on. The other thing that we know that government officials have been busy on, not least over the last few weeks, is around the industrial strategy. We know that the officials are busy thinking and drafting and probably redrafting the strategy that's due out sometime in autumn. And we had a Greg Clark speech last week where he started to talk a little bit about the industrial strategy. Naomi, what did he say? Did we learn anything new?
Well, in many ways, it reaffirmed what we already know about their priorities for the industrial strategy. Greg Clark was clear that he wanted it to be a long-lasting strategy and a strategy that's genuinely collaborative. And I think they've had over 2,000 responses to the consultation. So he talked about science and innovation, skills and infrastructure being at the heart of the industrial strategy, as it kind of always has been, really. But he feels that what's distinctive about the industrial strategy, as we've heard a number of times recently, is that it will reflect a kind of strong recognition of the importance of place. And he feels that this is what makes this strategy really quite distinctive. But of course, we're expecting a more detailed speech or more substantive speech next Monday.
Yeah.
We'll wait to hear more from Greg Clark on the industrial strategy.
It'll be interesting to see if we get much more detail from him in terms of particularly, I think, how the thinking around the sectors that they are continuing to do and the thinking around place and the degree to which those two things can be combined to get the outcomes that we all want.
Thanks to Brian and Naomi. Over the last 12 months, concerns about air quality and air pollution in our cities have become much more prominent in the mainstream press and policy agenda.
To help me explore these issues, I have two excellent guests. My first guest is Caroline Russell, Green Party member of the London Assembly. And in the Assembly, she's the chair of the Economy Committee and the deputy chair of the Environment Committee, amongst other things. And my second guest is Andrea Lee, healthy air campaigner for Client Earth. And she's worked on sustainability projects in the UK, but also in Spain and in the USA. So great guest to explore these sorts of issues. Welcome to you both. I want to start with the first issue, which to the casual observer, it appears that issues around air pollution, issues around air quality have suddenly risen up the political and the public agenda. In a sense, they've almost come from nowhere. Why is that, Caroline?
Well, I think there's been some very, very clever and strategic campaigning by politicians, by different campaign groups, by organisations like Client Earth, who've been kind of dealing with the legal side of things. I mean, I first became aware of air pollution as a serious issue, and particularly the diesel problem, back in 2011, and I got involved in one of the first two citizen science projects that happened in London, and measured air pollution in the area where I live, mm-hmm. and was utterly shocked at the levels of pollution that we were finding on really ordinary side roads, not even on the main roads. Mm-hmm. And I think what's happened over the last few years, 6-7 years, is that successive elections, and in particular the London elections, because the Mayor of London has so much power over transport and has so many of the levers that could actually improve air quality and reduce pollution. So people have used those elections as strategic opportunities to really raise it up the political agenda, so that by the most recent mayoral election, there was, you know, all the candidates were entirely behind the need to clean up London's air.
Mm-hmm. Andrea, Client Earth, I mean, you've been at this for a while, but in a sense, give us a sense as to why we see it now so much in the public debate and in the political debates.
Well, I think it strikes a chord with people, really, because it's not an environmental issue. It's about public health. This is something that is a pollutant, but it's not just affecting the environment. It's not something that, you know, that you can kind of think, oh, we'll think about the trees or the rivers. Mm. It's actually thinking about our lungs, our hearts, the children that are growing up in our cities, that, you know, whose lungs are being stunted by the air that they're breathing. And I think that's something that's really grabbing people's their sense of injustice, that this isn't right. So, you know, Client Earth, we've been working on air pollution issues pretty much since we started about 10 years ago. We raised concerns when the mayor at the time was looking at, effectively, if we removed the western extension to the congestion zone, and raised concerns about what the impact was going to be there. But our main piece of work in the UK has really come about from the UK government failing to meet those nitrogen dioxide legal limits in 2010, demonstrating that they weren't really going to be following the requirements under the law, and having to challenge them in court to actually get them to take some action.
Okay. So let's just unpack what the problem is. Not so much, we get to the response and and all the rest of it. But just for the sake of listeners, let's just unpack what, when we talk about air quality and the problems of, and air pollution and the problems of, what are we talking about? Caroline, you go first, give us a sense.
A lot of it comes down to transport issues.
Right.
There was a decision made to a few years back to make to give tax breaks to diesel vehicles,
right.
Because the CO2 emissions from diesel vehicles are lower than those from petrol vehicles. But rather than thinking, oh, we need to bring down our CO2 emissions and tackle climate change through transport, rather than taking a real challenging approach to the business as usual of cars being the default way that many people get around, and in investing in public transport and more walking and cycling, there was this decision made to give tax breaks to diesel cars. So we have had a huge, huge, huge increase in the number of diesel vehicles on the roads. And the unintended, I'm sure, consequences of this is really a public health catastrophe. With, in London, you know, about 9,500 premature deaths a year attributable to air pollution. This is, you know, it's affecting people's lung health, their heart health. People are, you know, just people tell me they feel chesty when they're walking to the shops to pick up a pint of milk. And it's really not fair that the air in our city is impacting people's daily lives like that. And talking to parents about asthma, the numbers of children with asthma, if you talk to school teachers, some of them will say, like, you know, half the children in their class have asthma pumps. Mm. When my kids, you know, they're now in their early 20s, were at school, you know, maybe two or three kids in the class of 30 had an asthma pump.
Mm.
It's really, you know, it's catastrophic, the effect that it's had on people's daily lives.
So what would you... Andrew, your thoughts on, you know, just outlining the nature of the problem as we, you know, as we see it when we think about air quality, air pollution.
Yeah, I mean, I know Caroline mentioned the unintended consequences of the sort of promotion of diesel vehicles. It wasn't that they didn't know about the side effects of diesel. So it was known at the time that diesel vehicles, whilst they were more fuel efficient, they did emit more particulate matter. And they also emitted more nitrogen oxides, which is the umbrella group of gases that includes the toxic element nitrogen dioxide, which we're concerned about. But it was a decision made, as Caroline said, that, you know, as a sort of almost lazy way of trying to meet the climate change obligations or targets, that switching technologies and hoping that the motoring industry would actually, you know, clean up its act and find ways of cleaning up diesel. Unfortunately, the regulations that were agreed allowed loopholes where, you know, as was exposed by the Volkswagen scandal, cars were being produced that weren't as clean in the lab tests as on the road as they are in the lab tests. And governments have known about this for a long time, but just cross their fingers and hope that at some point they would get cleaner. So we are in a situation where, you know, air pollution is shown to be, by the WHO, the World Health Organization, one of the biggest, well, the biggest environmental health risk across the world. It has a huge burden of health in the UK, as has been outlined. Last year, the Royal College of Physicians and the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health gathered all the available evidence and really showed how you know, air pollution affects us from the time that we're in the womb right through to old age.
Okay.
So, you know, there might be a lot of people out there who think, well, I'm feeling really healthy, I don't have asthma, all that sort of stuff. But what air pollution is doing is it's shortening all of our lifespans. It's a health risk. It's making our lives shorter. And for some people, those effects will be greater. And it's not just about shortening your lifespan, but it's also about your day-to-day. So Caroline mentioned people who struggle to breathe. You know, I've met plenty of people who, you know, on certain days they just can't leave the house. They're housebound by the air around them, which is ridiculous. And you know, we get contacted a lot by parents who are really concerned, you know, should I be bringing up my child in London? And other towns and cities as well. But, you know, this is not just a London problem, obviously. It's found right across the UK.
Yeah. I was going to say, do you think we'll get to some of the causes. You've touched on them already. We'll go into them in a second. in the nature of the problem? Is it predominantly an urban problem? I mean, you both referenced London. We could probably, similar if you look at Birmingham or Leeds or, you know, other cities across the UK and indeed cities elsewhere across the globe. But is it because of the nature of the problem is predominantly an urban problem?
It depends what type of pollution you're referring to.
Okay.
So at the moment we're concentrating a lot on the illegal levels of nitrogen dioxide, and that's because we have the opportunity to enforce or get the government to actually act on that. But there's other types of pollutants. A lot of them do have as a source road transport, but for instance there are also agricultural emissions,
right,
which can lead to problems, and you have problems with ozone, which can be formed by a mixture, especially by these agricultural emissions, but can travel quite a long distances. So some of the pollutants have a very localised effect.
Yeah.
So as you can imagine, living or being right next to a really busy road is not great for your health.
Mm-hmm.
But some pollutants can actually travel far from where they are being produced. And so you can be in the countryside and have a problem. And of course, there's also the problem, and we get contacted also quite regularly by people who live in small towns and villages, but that have an A road that cuts right through them.
Yeah.
And they have lorries and they have cars coming through. And, you know, this is traffic that's not benefiting their place.
No, it's just going to run through,
And it's also to do with exposure, because if you're inside a car, you are actually exposed to more concentrated pollution than if you're standing in the street, outside, or cycling in the street alongside. And if you're on a busy motorway or a road, even out in the countryside, if you're in queuing traffic and the car in front of you is spewing out, you know, it's got a broken catalytic converter or whatever, you know, you are breathing what's coming out of the tailpipe of the car in front of you. So it's sort of sitting in a kind of tube of pollution. So actually there is a huge incentive for people to drive less to avoid subjecting themselves to pollution.
Right. Okay.
So as well as these vehicles creating pollution, actually by driving you're subjecting yourself and any of your passengers to high pollution levels.
So that's the nature of the problem. In terms of the causes, you both talked about diesel, you talked about traffic. Is that the primary cause of the, you know, the air quality, air pollution issue, or are there several causes or factors that influence it?
Traffic and transport, that is the area where there is the biggest potential to change things, and to change things really fundamentally. I said earlier.
But is it the biggest contributor?
Yeah. Well, where illegal levels of nitrogen dioxide are found, the government has said that about up to 80% of that problem comes from road transport,
right,
and a great deal of that is from diesel vehicles.
Okay, yeah. And so traffic is a big issue. I'm wondering where, and so then your thoughts on, you know, whether it's overall traffic levels, because there's questions about congestion in the sense, and that the particular problems that congestion causes for emissions, over the nature of the vehicle that's on the road, i.e.
it's a horrible combination of both.
Okay.
So we have a perfect storm.
Yeah, right.
We have changes in technology,
yeah,
which are driving changes in traffic.
Yeah.
So you've got Uber, the Uber platform, which allows, you know, many more, there's so many more private hire vehicles on the roads now using Uber. There's the fact that everyone's ordering things from the internet and having those goods delivered, so all these Amazon packages which are being delivered everywhere,
mm-hmm,
creating more traffic. There's because there's more and more traffic, there's clever apps like Waze that kind of direct people down side roads to escape traffic, which means that people living on what were once residential side roads that were quite quiet, very often finding themselves with very high levels of traffic and therefore more pollution coming along. So there's all these issues that are kind of creating just higher traffic levels, lots of congestion.
Yeah.
And then you've got the issue of the actual vehicles themselves and
right,
the fact that so many more vehicles, and I'm sorry, I haven't got the precise figure of what the proportion of the diesel fleet is now at the tip of my tongue, but the number of diesel vehicles on the road has mushroomed, and it's snowballed, whatever the right word is, and so there's the pollution from those vehicles is is also sort of massive problem. What we should be doing is having a complete rethink, making sure that wherever people live, whether it's out in the country, in a small town, in a big city, out in outer London, people should have access to affordable, reliable forms of clean public transport.
Okay.
And routes that are safe for walking and cycling.
Okay.
And then you break that hold that the car manufacturers have over our transport system. You would never set out to devise a transport system that relied on individual car ownership.
Okay. We'll come back to those, to the responses, what we might do in different ways. So hold that thought, we'll come back to that. And Andrew, just finish up, well, expand on, add your own thoughts into the causes of the, you know, the issue. Traffic in a general sense, the vehicles that are making up that traffic, a big issue. Other thoughts on, you know, the causes of the problem?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it is important to note that the increase in diesels in the fleet, and so you have, I think it's something like around the mid-90s, diesel cars were only 5% of the car fleet, I think around 2011 we started seeing that actually new sales of cars for the first time, diesels were almost greater than petrols, mm-hmm. and you've got a much bigger composition of the diesel fleet, which I think is about 40% or so, which doesn't sound that big, but is actually having a huge impact. These, if you compare the emissions from the equivalent petrol vehicles to diesel vehicles, diesel vehicles emit far, far much more than petrol vehicles, and so you've got greater amount of traffic, and you've got, as part of that, you have a bigger component of that as being really heavy polluting vehicles. I mean, we're basically in a situation now that because of the ways that the regulations have gone, we are in a situation where new diesel lorries or general heavy goods vehicles on average are actually emitting less pollution than new diesel cars.
Yeah.
So I know a lot of people talk about, you know, don't blame the cars, you know, it's about buses, it's about lorries, but it's not. The actual technology that you need to clean up diesel is actually more cost-effective and easier to fit onto heavier vehicles.
Yes.
And so the regulations there have actually succeeded a lot more in reducing and bringing down pollution, whereas with diesel cars, the technology that you need there need space, which in a car, you know, space is very difficult to, you know, start adding bits on, and it adds a lot to the cost. So actually, sometimes in what the sort of the analysis that's been done quite a lot after the Volkswagen scandal is showing is that quite often it can be some of the bigger, heavier, bigger engined diesel cars, more expensive, that are better at sort of meeting the emission standards than actually the smaller ones.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And so, you know, I think all sources have to be tackled and all vehicles have to be tackled, but I know that there's a lot of people out there trying to pretend that diesel cars aren't part of the problem,
right.
And unfortunately they are.
They are, okay. Is there anything...
Say the cheating car makers. I mean, the fact that we've had... I think I heard on the radio this morning Mercedes doing a massive recall, Volkswagen, you know, actually fitting cheap devices so that the emissions coming, you know, these vehicles can tell when they're being tested, and then they clean up what's coming out for the tests,
okay.
So the tests show up as being cleaner than they are. We need to get to real world emissions. And the other problem is that these vehicles are not designed for city driving. A diesel can work efficiently on big intercity journeys on a motorway where the engine gets hot and keeps driving. But when you have the engine switching itself off at the traffic lights,
which
all
is
the
obviously
time,
made worse with congestion, travel speeds are
declining.
Actually,
means that
the
catalytic converters don't ever get to work properly because they never got hot enough.
Okay, well, so technology designed for one thing and the use is actually for another thing, and therefore you get a misfit between them. Okay, so let's turn to responses. Andrea, just Before we get into the detail, just give, can you give us a sort of summary of the responses that we've seen so far, you know, at government level or intergovernment level around this sort of, you know, since this issue is a big issue, well, how would you characterise or summarise the way that the government is thinking about this issue thus far? We can get into the pros and cons of that in a minute, but just for the uninitiated, just give us a sense as to how government and governments are responding to this. Yeah. This sort of problem.
So this has been a problem caused by successive governments, and some members of former governments have held their hands up and said, you know, we got it wrong.
Yeah.
And you know, some current politicians are choosing to hark back to they caused the problem, but what we really need is the current government to get a grip, and certainly what we have been seeing in response to our legal challenges, where we are asking the government to come up with an effective plan that will meet the legal limits as short as possible. The law is very clear about what needs to be included about that. We've seen them really just sort of really tinkering around the edges.
So we've got targets, is that right? But your concern is not the target per se. It's the plan by which to deliver the target. So can you say something about what the target is and then come back to this question about whether the target will ever be met? Because...
Yeah, so the target is to meet the legal limit of nitrogen dioxide, which is the annual limit is 200 micrograms per meter cubed,
right,
as an average concentration level. And so we should have met this in 2010. The law does allow for the government to have applied for time extensions, providing it actually, you know, produce plans to show how it was going to do that in as short a time as possible. But at the time in our first legal challenge, the government actually for 16 zones, so the UK is divided into 43 zones for purposes of air quality reporting.
Yeah.
For 16 zones in particular, it basically said, oh, it's too hard. And this included places like London, West Midlands.
Yeah.
It's simply too hard. We're not going to apply for time extensions, but trust us, we'll get on with it.
Yeah.
7 years down the line, we're still not getting on with it.
Okay.
We still haven't seen any sort of plan. So in 2010, the status was that only 3 out of 43 zones met these legal limits of air pollution. In 2015, which is actually the deadline for the possible time extensions, this had only improved to 6 out of 43. So we still have 37 zones across the UK that are still having illegal and harmful levels of air pollution.
And within those zones, I presume the problem is getting worse. Is that right, given what you've described around traffic growth, you know, problems around the growth of diesels as a proportion of overall traffic growth? Is that right?
It sort of varies,
okay.
But the main concern is that it's not getting better.
Right.
It's not getting better quick
okay.
enough, because the law says you have to do it in the shortest time as possible.
Right.
And so what the government's strategy seems to have been, and we saw it very clearly in the 2015 plans, was that, you know, their hope is that as people naturally renew their cars, buy new cars, or businesses buy new vehicles, that these will be cleaner, and so natural fleet turnover will result in emissions reductions, which kind of does happen. But we question, and I think anyone will question whether that's actually actively doing something to.
You're relying on the individual decisions and some technology improvements, but no. There's no incentive necessarily, there's no
it's not getting on with it as
guidance
as
on it, there's no kind of policy associated with that. Carol, yeah,
well,
thoughts
also
on that?
The car manufacturers are still selling diesels as clean and as appropriate for driving in a city, and
right.
they're just not
I
fit
know.
For purpose.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, I mean, I completely agree with Andrea that the government has just felt it's like at every opportunity they've tried to push this into the long grass, they just don't want to deal with it. Because it does actually require a really radical rethink about how we get around, and thinking about transport as providing mobility for people, providing access to healthcare, to education, to work, to shops from wherever people live, but not predicated on the idea of individual car ownership. Because if you if we just swap all these dirty diesels for electric cars, we're not actually going to solve the problem of congestion. We're not going to solve the terrible health problems of physical inactivity. And we're also still going to have PM2.5 pollution, which are these tiny little particles from the tyre wear. So as these electric cars roll around on our roads, these little particles, which are the ones that get deep into our lungs.
Yeah, so that's quite that is quite a radical change, which I'm all in favour of. Before we get into that, is the government getting anything right in this area?
Well,
I mean, in that sort of general sense, for balance and...
What we're seeing is that their sort of experts know what needs to be done.
Right.
So we had our first legal challenge, which resulted in 2015, the Supreme Court in the UK ordered the government to come up with new plans.
Yeah.
And as part of those plans, what they did is they mandated five cities to have what's called clean air zones. They used to be referred to also as low emission zones.
Mm-hmm.
So London already has a low emission zone, but that only really includes some of the heavier vehicles and some of the heavier vans, not all vehicles. And obviously, the Mayor of London, Boris, proposed and put in place what's going to be the ultra low emission zone in the central London area that was going to come in 2020. But what they did in these 2015 plans is that actually using that sort of model from the ultra low emission zone, they say, well, we'll have five cities, which are Southampton, Birmingham, Nottingham, Leeds, and Derby. We'll have these zones, which basically will set emission standards for all a range of vehicles, depending on the different class of clean air zones. And then basically, if your vehicle doesn't meet that emission standard, you you choose to travel into that zone with that vehicle, you'll essentially have to pay for doing that.
Okay, so it's like a variation on the congestion charge that we've got in London.
Based on emissions.
Yeah,
so
based on emissions.
That's a very sort of basic way of doing things, and obviously we've been calling for a national network of clean air zones for a long time. What we saw in the second legal challenge, because those plans were still not good enough, is that actually when they were developing those 2015 plans, the government's own experts were recommending that there should be a greater number of clean air zones. And we saw a list of 16 cities that should have been mandated with these clean air zones.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the Treasury wanting to save money and wanting to get by doing the bare minimum only approved five. So we know that the government's own experts know that there should have been more. And
so are those five in operation?
No, so they're still undergoing feasibility
right.
studies. So they've been mandated to do it. They've been given some support. But from what I've been hearing, the support really hasn't really been enough, and the coordination has really been lacking. The government confirmed what is going to be a national framework for clean air zones, because you do need these things to be standardised.
Right.
What you can't have is one city having different standards and different ways of working, because if you're, for instance, a fleet operator...
Yeah, you want to know, you want to have some degree of consistency.
Exactly.
So that idea of the clean air zone is something that you're supportive of. You've got questions about speed of implementation in the pilot areas or the four or five areas, plus you would want to extend it out to essentially cover all of the UK.
To see them where the analysis shows that they're needed.
There's a problem.
And
okay.
What we haven't seen is really the government, and we saw this again in the recently draft improved plans that they put out for consultation, but again, there they were saying that maybe 27 local authorities might need clean air zones. But they haven't said where, and they haven't said what they're going to do about it.
It's just a sort of vague statement of intent without any follow-through on that.
If you read the technical report, they've done analysis, they've compared it to other sort of measures, because there isn't going to be one silver bullet, but this is actually quite a key measure. They've compared it and shown in their analysis that this is by far the most effective way of tackling the problem.
Okay.
But what they actually have written in the draft plans is that because also another part of their angle is to basically pass the buck down to local authorities, even though it's their legal responsibility, they've said that what they want actually is local authorities to come up with a plan to show how they're going to tackle the illegal levels of air pollution in their areas. And before, instead of just saying, right, well, we've done our analysis, clean air zone would be really good for you, they are going to require local authorities in England to do a whole load of research, a whole load of analysis, and to try and prove that there's nothing, absolutely nothing else that they can't do that would be the equivalent, even though they haven't been able to come up with any alternative measures that would be just as effective as these clean air zones. We just think that that's just...
That's just a waste. Maybe a waste of time, but also a way of extending the period before anything happens. Karen, Andreas talked a little bit about these different places. London has been thinking about and doing stuff in this area. I'm sure you'd like it to go further and do much more. Can you just give us a summary as to where we are in terms of, you know, what London's been up to in this context? And
started off, you mentioned the congestion zone, and Andrea mentioned the extension of the congestion zone, which was cancelled by Boris Johnson when he was mayor. But the congestion zone is a really simple system of charging for road use, and therefore minimising demand for road use and cutting down on the amount of traffic. And it's once you go into the zone inside the cordon, you pay a fee, and once you've paid that fee, you can drive around as much as you like for that day. So there is no incentive to people to drive less. It's a very, very crude mechanism. And it's also a mechanism that is tough.
Well, they will drive less if they don't want to pay the charge.
Because once you've paid it then you can drive around as much as you like.
So it doesn't influence you once you've made the payment.
Once you've made the payment.
It will influence you whether you're prepared to make the payment in the first
instance. Absolutely, but once you've paid it, it's like saying to someone, okay, give us a tenner and you can bring your cigar and smoke in our playground.
Yeah.
And spend the whole day doing it. You know, it's there's no extra pounds for extra cigars. The situation for London at the moment is we've got the ultra low emission zone coming in, which is going to start off just in the central congestion charge zone. But the mayor is looking to take it out to the North and South Circular, and many people want it to extend to cover the whole of London. Now the mayor has got to review the congestion charging payment mechanisms, because that's all now, it's about 20 years old, isn't it, I think? TfL have said repeatedly in assembly scrutiny meetings that they're reviewing it, and that they are thinking about combining the congestion charge payment mechanism with the clean air payment mechanism, so that there might be one payment mechanism. And I think that they are also looking at whether they can make it relate to the time of day, so the different charges for busy times of day and smaller charges at quiet times of day, and also make it distance related and emissions related. So there is some interesting thinking going on at the moment, which there's been report after report for. There was a report done before the London Assembly was first kind of brought into being, that concluded that road pricing was something that the Mayor of London should consider and should think about. Because
I'm a big fan of road pricing.
And I'm a big fan of road pricing. It's one of my first questions to the Mayor was about road pricing and traffic reduction. And there is a growing body of evidence and a growing body of people who think that road pricing could be a useful solution, and it would be a way of combining the kind of congestion reduction along with the air pollution controls as well. So I would be very, very surprised if London doesn't move towards a system that is going to actually regulate use of our roads, because our streets are a precious resource, precious public space. And at the moment, there's a complete free-for-all, and it's not working for anyone, because if the roads are really busy, the buses don't work efficiently, so more people get tempted to take a taxi, which adds even more to the congestion. And it's the system is just not really working at the moment.
That's interesting. Get your thoughts on that, Andrea. But is it fair to say that London is leading ahead of the government in this sort of thinking? Or I'm curious about whether cities themselves, and we were interested in cities and taking responsibility for the issues that their city experiences and suffers from, or the benefits that they get. and really making, having the responsibility for doing this sort of stuff. So I'm wondering whether we think that our cities are trying to respond to this, or are they very much fallen on behind from where the government kind of is?
Yeah, I think you would definitely say that London in the UK has been leading the way. You know, the introduction of the ultra low emission zone that was proposed back in 2014 was really, I think, really bold.
Yeah.
Didn't go as far enough for us.
Yeah.
But it was a real key step, and it also helped shape the sort of thinking for other cities. But I think we are also seeing, locally a lot more responsibility being taken for wanting to deal with the problem. I've been in meetings with MPs, who have come to maybe green environmental roundtables to talk about the issues, and even under Chatham House rules, they don't really want to address the issue of having to tackle road transport and have less vehicles on the road and clean those ones up. They like to jump straight to electric vehicles, and they don't really want to think about major change.
Why is that? What's the reason that they give?
Well, I they don't give a reason. They just get over it. But I know that it is politically. It's a very hard line to be seen as anti-motorist. And so what we need to do is have these politicians stop thinking about being anti-motorist.
But if you could be, I'm not saying that, I wouldn't say anti-motorist, but if you could be more respectful of other modes of transport, if you're going to do that anywhere, you would do that in cities, right? I mean, in a sense where the ability to introduce public transport or alternatives to private vehicles offers the best chance. I mean, in deep countryside,
that's
very difficult, more challenging, not impossible, more difficult. If you're in Birmingham, or if you're in Manchester, if you're in London, there is a possibility, at least, that alternative modes of transport are possible. Mm. So if it was going to come from anywhere, I would hope that it comes from our our urban areas, not only our big ones, but certainly be led by some of our bigger cities.
Well, that's the change I've seen. I think earlier this year I was sitting in a room with councillors and council officers talking about this.
Yeah.
And that's the first time I was hearing politicians that weren't, people or from political parties that already really engaged in the issue, actually saying, if we're going to get to grips with this problem, we know we have to do something about road transport, and we know we have to do something about cars. And I was just stunned. And I was thinking, okay, well, we're in a private meeting, this is... It's still great. I'm not going to want to tell people about this, but this is great. But then actually, a few weeks later, you saw Birmingham City Council, publicly saying on radio that because they've been tasked with setting up a clean air zone, and their initial analysis is showing that actually cars are a problem.
Yeah.
But we're only mandated to put in a clean air zone that doesn't include cars. So they only have to address emissions from, I think, buses, heavy goods vehicles, taxis. But there's local authorities there that say, well, if we're going to do this, let's do it right. And if the analysis shows that cars need to be a part of this, then we need to include cars.
Yeah.
But obviously for them, the worry is that they're much closer to the voter.
Yeah.
And people get
not
very
quite.
So they really, that's where. You see these local authority leadership coming out, and they're recognising their problem, but they really need the government to back them up.
Yes, well, I think that is a great point. You need to, I mean, what's been interesting, I think, from our observation, get your thought on this, guy, is we are at the centre of cities where, as I said, we're strongly in favour of road pricing. We're also strongly in favour of congestion charging in some shape or form, particularly in some of our urban areas where congestion is very, very high, very problematic. And it's not only places like the centre of Manchester, it's actually places like Cambridge, got awful transport problems. Very difficult to envisage how you can deal with that without introducing some kind of pricing mechanism. But interesting, what you've seen recently from some of the politicians is nervousness, that's a given, but also beginning to talk about not a congestion charge necessarily, but a clean air charge, or which is, it's the same mechanism, but the frame of reference is shifted, and who can argue against having better air quality?
I would say that it's not just the frame of reference that's changing. Unfortunately, I think what one of our criticisms would be of some of these systems that are being shown up is that they're not joining up, as Caroline was explaining, what you need to do with road pricing, perhaps, is you know, you've got to join up the problem of emissions and congestion.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, the ultra low emission zone as it was proposed made it very clear. I was almost at pains to make clear that what it wasn't trying to do is to reduce the number of vehicles on the road.
No.
It was just trying to encourage the cleaner ones on
yeah.
the road, which will do something, but it's still not going to solve the problem. So,
no.
And with the clean air zones, they are being set up mainly to drive cleaner vehicles on the road, not to address the problem of congestion.
But they will have a they would. I would anticipate they would
yeah.
have.
But they'll only be good as a designer.
No, but
yeah, yeah.
we like unintended
yeah.
consequences as
yeah.
well as intended
yeah.
if they're in the positive
we,
frame.
We like a bit more certainty.
Yeah, no, I appreciate
legal perspective,
that. No, no.
We need to be a bit more certain.
I'm completely with you on that. However, nevertheless, I do celebrate when we get good outcomes, even if people didn't anticipate those good outcomes coming about.
You're making a lot of assumptions about how politicians think, because I think that people, because this has now become such a health issue and people are so aware of the health implications, they are beginning to, and also because what I talked about at the beginning of the kind of change in the nature of traffic and
yeah.
the fact that congestion is such a problem. You know, driving, I was down near Basingstoke Hospital the other day, my mother was in there, and those roads, particularly at busy times of day, are just nose to tail
yeah.
cars.
Yeah.
No one's having a good time. I was just thinking, they should have a tram going from Reading to Basingstoke. And, you know, you could get rid of, at a stroke, of a load of this traffic and have some decent bike routes, because the journey
yeah.
times are, you know, the distances are short enough for lots of people to be able to do
yeah.
some of those journeys by bike. So, but I think that politicians are beginning to be told by the residents in their areas, and this is sort of local councillors, that actually they think of their health as being more important than the ability to be able to drive and
mm-hmm.
park
mm-hmm.
everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
People, particularly in inner London, you know, in a borough like Islington, only 33% of residents have access to a car or van.
Absolutely.
So the vast majority of people are making all their journeys on foot, by bike, by public transport, and, or, you know, by taxi.
That is peculiarly particular to London, as you know.
That is particular to London.
It's not criticism, it's just an observation.
It's an interesting shift. So, for instance, my son is 24, has had driving lessons on the table since his 18th birthday, and he has not had a single driving lesson, because he can get around everywhere where he, if he wants to go between cities, he goes by train, books in advance, can use his computer or laptop or whatever sort of while he's travelling.
Yeah.
The idea, the aspiration to drive, I think, is less, certainly within cities, is, you know, it's coming down from how it used to be in the past. We've also got the other technological trend, which is driverless cars coming in,
mm-hmm.
which may well also intersect with this. And I think that the, I think people are beginning to see that their life, you know, they're seeing examples like Waltham Forest, Mini Holland, where they've, just by putting in a few bollards and closing off some roads to through traffic,
yeah.
they have managed to make a whole neighbourhood much quieter and much more pleasant for people who are walking and cycling. So you can still drive to every home in the area,
yeah.
but you can't cut through from one main road to another.
Mm-hmm.
And people are beginning to see that actually those kind of shifts in the way that we manage our streets have huge benefits to people's daily lives, to the fact that people feel safer about letting their kids walk to school and, you know, all of that kind of thing. And it's, so I think that the status quo of being stuck with car use as the default way for people to get around is actually pretty miserable.
No, I agree with that.
People are open and are ready for alternatives and different ways of doing things. And, you know, with the sort of technology is shifting, sort of apps which allow car sharing so that people can have access to a car for those occasions where they do need to use that kind
yeah.
of mobility.
Yeah.
And I just think we shouldn't be too hidebound and frightened of the idea of the motorist getting cross.
No,
I'm a motorist.
I know how to drive, but I also see that this
cult of enabling car use before any other kind of transport is actually a real problem for us across the country, not just in our cities.
No, I think that's absolutely right, and, you know, I would favour that completely. In a sense, I suppose it's an interesting way of thinking about dealing with the problem, which doesn't necessarily. Well, the question then, you know, it doesn't necessarily need big grand plans from on high. It's actually incremental, it's experimental, it's local.
It's many.
So I'm not saying that they're mutually exclusive, but there are lots of things, and the sort of things that you've just described going on in London are going on in other places as well through a series of. I'm not saying that's the only thing we should be doing, but it does show us a way that we can get some of where we want to get to, in absence almost of having, you know, these clear plans from government, which rarely are sophisticated or nuanced enough to really get what we want.
There's one other thing that's really important to think about, which is transport poverty. There are so many people living in rural areas who have real difficulty accessing the shops or jobs or, you know, their job or whatever. You know, the fact that if you live in a rural area, you are condemned to having to use a car to get around the place, means that some people are really disbenefited from that, by that. And actually providing good quality, reliable, regular public transport can not only help tackle air pollution, but it can also provide huge, huge social benefit. And, you know, that's something that we should be, you know, that the government should be thinking about as they tackle this massive public health crisis of air pollution. They should also be thinking about the other public benefit that comes from taking a strategic, overarching look at our transport system and kind of getting out of the clutches of the car manufacturers, who have people trapped on a continuous cycle of buying new cars.
Okay, I know.
They're selling stuff into business.
However, let's not assume that the consumer is completely blind or uninitiated or uneducated in the choices that they make. No, the consumer knows what they're... You know,
it's
you have
a
to
big assume, financial what, process of I, loans I, and everything else.
I get that, but you know, I think I'm not defending the motoring industry in any shape or form, but I am saying that I think consumers make choices about what they want to do and what they want to purchase, and, you know, and they make those knowingly, not with perfect information, but they do make those sort of questions and issues knowingly. Anyway, your thoughts on, so let's shift gear as we begin to think about closing. Can you give us a sense as to where we are in the UK vis-a-vis other international comparators on this sort of, on these sorts of issues? Have you looked at the way that, you know, the UK thinks about this vis-a-vis other European countries or America or anywhere else?
So, I mean, across Europe, in terms, because the legal limits that we're talking about come from a European directive.
Yeah.
The UK is by no means the only country that that has failed to meet these limits.
Yeah.
It's been failed across the EU, And so, what, you know, it is quite a hard task. And what the UK has maybe is actually quite one of the biggest problems, partly because we have invested a lot more. We've gone further down the route of going down the diesel route than other countries in the EU. But also, if you compare to what's happened to in the States and also in Japan, for instance, where they also, you know, wanted to tackle climate change and looked at options, but they didn't, you know, the US and Japan didn't go down the diesel routes.
Right.
They actually just tightened down on fuel efficiency overall.
Right. So the diesel issue is not exceptional to us, but we are one of the countries
that have gone quite far down the route. It's particularly, I guess, a Western Europe problem.
Yeah.
And for instance, having London as one of the biggest cities, we have, you know, I think it was... It was said, there was a bit of a spat a few years ago where scientists said that the London has some of the highest recorded levels of nitrogen dioxide in the world. London also has one of the best air quality monitoring networks, so it's a bit of a, you know, unfortunate situation.
We're better
situation.
At measuring
we're better
it,
so
really
we're better
bad.
In our problem. But they're fairly high.
Right.
And, you know, on some hand, if you compare maybe a city like London to other European cities, you know, with the ULEZ, we're actually showing that, you know, it's going to be possibly, it has been said, one of the biggest ultra-low emission zones. Hopefully, with the proposed expansion, we would like CityCon to think about expanding the ULEZ to the whole of Greater London for all vehicles, if the analysis shows that that's needed. You know, but other, you know, Germany has a network of over 100 low emission zones. These are all geared up to tackle particulate matter pollution, not nitrogen dioxide, but they've already got a network of 100 that, you know, that people use. Other cities are probably better maybe at raising awareness of what's the problem. So until recently, you know, in London you didn't have that many alerts. That's one great thing that he has brought in, is these new pollution alerts. Yeah. We were having these in Belgium for many years, right, where you'd, every public transport signage was showing people when there was high pollution.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have seen bold statements from places such as Paris and Madrid, where they're talking about banning diesel cars from 2025. When you look at the details, sometimes these equate really to an ultra low emission zone. But I think there is a need to be bold in giving direction. And I think that's where we do need, you know, we would say you do need that national plan to be visionary and to show what action the government is going to take, because there are some national policies that need to be addressed, such as the vehicle excise duty that still incentivizes diesel, other policies, investment money to help invest in public transport infrastructure and walking and cycling. But you know, I think it is about providing that vision and that clear direction of where we want to go.
Yeah.
So, you know, for us, clean air zones aren't just about preventing these dirty vehicles from coming into the busy places.
No.
They need to be supported by, you know, infrastructure, by behaviour change, by, you know, I think that's where you can say, great if local authorities can innovate. But they need to do it within a framework that's going to really guarantee that you're driving to, you know, you're kind of moving towards a healthier, you know, healthier future where, you know, we don't have to worry so much. You're not going to get rid of all pollution, unfortunately.
No.
There's still going to be, you know, particulate matter, there's natural sources, there's artificial sources. But, you know, we do need that national strategy, that clear direction, the framework, the resources and support from central government
to help cities
do that.
Yeah. So, Guy, just get your thoughts on, and then Andrea, come back in. Next 5, 10 years. I mean, what's the agenda at the city level, at the London level? What we know, if you were imagining out the next 5 or 10 years, what would you?
Listening
would you want to see
to residents,
right,
listening to people who live and work here, and they want to know that they can trust the air they breathe.
Right.
And there is a huge appetite for radical shift in our transport policy. Meeting people, I've been meeting people all over London, people living in outer London boroughs in particular, people who live underneath these massive motorway kind of flyovers that come into London, people in Enfield living right by the North Circular. These people are all saying, we want choices, we want alternatives, we don't want to have to use our car every day. It's really horrible having to be stuck in traffic jams. It's not a great way to live in a city. So I think that is a big opportunity. The fact that everyday households, people are going to public meetings in dusty church halls across the city, telling their local politicians that they want choices, they want to be freed from using a car in London because it's inefficient as a way of getting around. And I think that there is a huge amount of legacy fear amongst politicians, because in the past it has been difficult to bring in, you know, as much as a parking restriction on a particular road. You know, the sort of, we are reaching a point of congestion on our roads where driving a car is no longer a pleasant choice. And that is an opportunity. It's an opportunity for us potentially to have streets that are much more people friendly, where our cities are great places to live. We know the economic benefits of making cities that are less vehicle focused and more people focused. So I think we should actually be very hopeful. I think that there are huge, huge opportunities, and we could actually have a city that had many, many fewer cars in it, where many people still have access to a car, but it might not be a car that they own. It might be a car that they have as part of a car club, or whether it's, you know, sort of taxi use or whatever. But where the air is cleaner, we're all an awful lot healthier, And you know, the public realm is actually a decent place rather than a filthy, dirty place with vehicles parked down both sides and queuing to move along the street on both lanes of the road.
Okay.
I mean, I think London is a particular you know, place, and from the work that we've been doing in campaigning, you know, we wanted to really use what was going on in London to sort of springboard action elsewhere. But I think what we're finding is that actually outside London, awareness is actually not as high as you would want it to be. In fact, it's pretty low, and I think that's where it's. I think there's a lot of opportunity maybe with some of the metro mayors. Obviously, they only cover some cities, not the whole of the UK. Because what we can't do is really afford. We can't afford to have to go through the you know, the many years that we've had campaigning in London to raise awareness and really drive that public interest and that political interest. And I think that's where, you know, we need to realise also, I kind of also realise that, you know, other cities don't want to be like London, and they can't be. They are very different. You know, you have the whole West Midlands area, which is a completely different situation. And so I think, you know, there are lessons that can be learnt from London, but I think we need people to really work on a vision of what these sort of cities will look like that are not non-London cities would look like. And I think that will hopefully maybe come from the metro mayors. I think a lot of sort of urban specialists really need to turn their attention maybe a little bit away from London. You know, I've been meeting with people who, you know, very keen to say, you know, how can we work on providing a vision for London? It's like, well, there's all sort of people working on a vision for London.
Yeah, there are other
work
places.
On a vision for, you know, Birmingham or Liverpool or somewhere else or Nottingham. Well,
Nottingham's really visionary.
They've done some interesting stuff.
Parking levy, paid for their tram. You know, they really thought about how do we tackle congestion. How do we use that to raise money to invest in public transport?
Yeah.
So you get into a virtuous circle. So Nottingham is a really good example of somewhere where they've done good stuff.
So I think we need a bit more focus because this is not just a London problem. London has got the biggest problem in the UK, but it is across the country. And so, you know, I think we need those decision makers, those policy makers to not wait for the public to catch up. I mean, we would love, one of the things we would love is the government to do is to do a public awareness campaign to raise that awareness, but to be honest, if they didn't do that and they got on with it and actually, you know, addressed the root causes and started taking, you know, action, I much prefer that. But always more useful if you can bring the public with you.
Yeah, yeah.
And also partly you do need that public support. You need to explain to people why we do need things like congestion or clean air zones or road user charging. You know, you need to bring them with you and make them understand that what you're trying to, you're not trying to restrict them. What you're trying to do is open up the urban areas for them.
Great. My guests today have been Caroline Russell and Andrea Lee. Thanks very much for being part of City Talks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.